The Fraud of Feminism, Part 3, Hysteria. Dr. Paul Sainton of the Faculty of Medicine, Paris, says, quote, "The appearance of a symptom of hysteria generally proves that the malady has already existed for some time, though latent. The name of a provocative agent of hysteria is given to any circumstance which suddenly reveals the malady, but the real cause of the disorder is a hereditary disposition. If the real cause is unique, the provocative agents are numberless. The moral emotions, grief, fright, anger, and other psychic disturbances are the most frequent causes of hysterical affections, and in every walk of life, subjects are equally liable to attacks." Close quote. Hysteria may appear at any age. It is common with children, especially during the 5 or 6 years preceding puberty. Of 33 cases under 12 years, which came under Dr. Still's notice, 23 were in children over 8 years. Hysteria in women is most frequent between the ages of 15 and 30, and most frequently of all between 15 and 20. As a rule, there is a tendency to cessation after the change. It frequently happens, however, that the disease is continued into an advanced period of life. "There is constant change," says Professor Albert Moll, "from a cheerful to a depressed mood. From being free and merry, the woman, in a short time, becomes sulky and sad, while a moment before she was capable of entertaining a whole company without pause, talking to each member about that which interested him. Shortly afterwards, she does not speak a word more. I may mention the well-worn example of the refusal of a new hat as being capable of converting the most lively mood into its opposite. The weakness of will shows itself here in that the nervous woman," and by nervous, Dr. Moll means what is commonly termed hysterical, "the nervous woman cannot, like the normal one, command the expression of her emotions. She can laugh uninterruptedly over the most indifferent matter until she falls into veritable laughing fits. The crying fits, which we sometimes observe, belong to the same category. When the nervous woman is excited about anything, she exhibits outbreaks of fury, wanting all the characteristics of womanhood, and she is not able to prevent these emotional outbursts. In the same way, just as the emotions weaken the will, and the woman cannot suppress this or that action, it is noticeable in many nervous women that quite independently of these emotions, there is also a tendency to continuous alterations in their way of acting. It has been noticed, as characteristic of many nervous persons, that their only consistency lies in their inconsistency, but this must in no way be applied to all nervous persons. On this disposition, discoverable in the nature of so many nervous women, rests the craving for change, as manifested in the continual search for new pleasures, theatres, concerts, parties, tours, and other things, things that to the normal woman are indifferent, or to which she has, in a sense, accustomed herself, are to the nervous woman a source of constant worry. Although she may perfectly well know that the circumstances of herself and her husband are the most brilliant, and that it is unnecessary for her to trouble herself in the least about her material position as regards the future, nevertheless, the idea of financial ruin constantly troubles her. Thus, if she is a millionaire's wife, she never escapes from constant worry. Similarly, the nervous woman creates troubles out of things that are unavoidable. If in the course of years she gets more wrinkles and her attraction for man diminishes, this may easily become a source of lasting sorrow for the nervous woman. we now have to consider a point which is being continually urged by feminists in the present day when confronted with the pathological mental symptoms so commonly observed in women, which are usually regarded as having their origin in hysteria. We often hear it said by feminists in answer to arguments based on the above fact, "Oh, but men can also suffer from hysteria." In England, says Dr. Buzzard, hysteria is comparatively rarely met with in males, the female sex being much more prone to the affection. The proportion of males to females in hysteria is, according to Dr. Pitra, 1-3. According to Bodensheim, 1-10. And according to Brieke, 1-20. The author of the article on hysteria in the Encyclopaedia Britannica, 11th edition, 1911, also gives 1-20 as a numerical proportion between male and female cases. Dr. Pitra, in the work just cited, gives 82% of cases of convulsions in women as against 22% in men. But in all this, under the concept hysteria, are included, and indeed chiefly referred to, various physical symptoms of a compulsive and epileptic character, which are quite distinct from the mental conditions rightly or wrongly connected or even identified with hysteria in the popular mind and by many medical authorities. But even as regards hysteria in the former sense of the word, a sharp line of distinction based on a diagnosis of cases was long ago drawn by medical men between hysteria masculina and hysteria feminina, and in the present day eminent authorities such as Dr. Bernard Hollander would deny that the symptoms occasionally diagnosed as hysteria in men are identical with or due to the same causes as the somewhat similar conditions known in women under the same name. After all, this whole question, in its broader bearings, is more a question of common sense observation than one for medical experts. What we are here chiefly concerned with as hysteria, in accordance with the popular usage of the term, are certain pathological mental symptoms in women that are open to everybody's observation and denied by no one unprejudiced by feminist views. Every impartial person has only to cast his eye around his female acquaintance and to recall the various women of all classes, conditions, and nationalities that he may have come into contact with in the course of his life to recognize those symptoms of mental instability commonly called hysterical, as obtaining in at least a proportion of one to every 4 or 5 women he has known, to a marked and unmistakable degree. The proportion is, in fact, stated in an official report to the Peruvian government issued some 10 years back as that noticeable among female clerks, post office servants, and other women employed in the Peruvian civil service. Certainly, as regards women in general, the observation of myself and others who I have questioned on the subject would seem to indicate that the proportions given in the Peruvian civil service report as regards the number of women afflicted in this way are rather under than overstated. There are many medical men who aver that no woman is entirely free from such symptoms, at least immediately before and during the menstrual period. The head surgeon at a well-known London hospital informed a friend of mine that he could always tell when this period was on or approaching with his nurses by the mental change which came over them. Now, these pathological symptoms, noticeable in a slight and more or less unimportant degree in the vast majority, if not indeed in all women, and in a marked pathological degree in a large proportion of women, it is scarcely too much to say, do not occur at all in men. I have indeed known, I think, 2 men, and only 2, in the course of my life, exhibiting mental symptoms analogous to those commonly called hysterical in women. On the other hand, my own experience, and it is not alone, is that very few women with whom I have come into more or less frequent contact, socially or otherwise, have not at times shown the symptoms referred to in a marked degree. If, therefore, we are to admit the bare possibility of men being afflicted in a similar way, it must be conceded that such cases represent such rarus avis as to be negligible for practical purposes. A curious thing, in pronounced examples of this mental instability in women, is that the symptoms are often so very similar in women of quite different birth, surroundings, and nationality. I can recall at the present moment three cases, each different as regards birth, class, and in one case nationality, but yet who are liable to develop the same symptoms under the influence of quite similar idee fixe. But it seems hardly necessary to labour the point in question at any greater length. The whole experience of mankind since the dawn of written records, confirmed by, as above said, that of every living person, not specially committed to the theories of modern feminism, bears witness alike to the prevalence of what we may term the hysterical mind in woman, and to her general mental frailty. It is not for nothing that women and children have always been classed together. This view, based as it is on the unanimous experience of mankind, and confirmed by the observation of all independent persons, has, I repeat, not been challenged before the appearance of the present feminist movement, and hardly by anyone outside the ranks of that movement. It is not proposed here to dilate at length on the fact, often before insisted upon, of the absence throughout history of the signs of genius, and with a few exceptions of conspicuous talent, in the human female, in art, science, literature, invention, or affairs. The fact is incontestable. And if it be argued that this absence in women of genius, or even of a high degree of talent, is no proof of the inferiority of the average woman to the average man, then the answer is obvious. Apart from conclusive proof, the fact of the existence in all periods of civilization, and even under the higher barbarism, of exceptionally gifted men and never of a correspondingly gifted woman, does undoubtedly afford an indication of inferiority of the average woman as regards the average man. From the height of the mountain peaks, we may, other things equal, undoubtedly conclude the existence of a tableland beneath them, in the same tract of country whence they arise. I have already in the present podcasts, besides elsewhere, referred to the fallacy that intellectual or other fundamental inferiority in woman existing at the present day is traceable to any alleged repression in the past, since Weismann and his denial of transmission of acquired characteristics apart, assuming, for the sake of the argument, such repression to have really attained the extent alleged, and its effects to have been transmitted to future generations, it is against all the laws of heredity that such transmission should have taken place through the female line alone, as is contended by the advocates of this theory. Referring to this point, Herbert Spencer has expressed the conviction of most scientific thinkers on the subject when he declares a difference between the mental powers of men and women to result from a physiological necessity, and that no amount of culture can obliterate it. He further observes that the relative deficiency of the female mind is in just those most complex faculties, intellectual and moral, which have political action for their sphere. One of the points, as regards the inferiority of women, which feminists are willing and even eager to concede, and it is the only point of which this can be said, is that of physical weakness. The reason why they should be particularly anxious to emphasize this deficiency in the sex is not difficult to discern. It is the only possible semblance of an argument which can be plausibly brought forward to justify the female privileges in certain directions. It does not really do so, but it is the sole pretext which they can adduce with any show of reason at all. Now, it may be observed that, 1, the general frailty of woman would militate cotaris paribus against their own dogma of the intellectual equality between the sexes, and 2, that this physical weakness is more particularly a muscular weakness, since constitutionally the organism of the female has enormous power of resistance and resilience in general, far greater than that of man. It is a matter of common observation that the average woman can pass through strains and recover in a way few men can do. But as we shall have occasion to revert to these two points at greater length later on, we refrain from saying more here. How then, after consideration, shall we judge of the feminist thesis, affirmed and reaffirmed, insisted upon by so many as an incontrovertible axiom, that woman is the equal intellectually and morally, if not physically, of man? Surely that it has all the characteristics of a true dogma. Its votaries might well say with Tertullian, credo quia absurdum. It contradicts the whole experience of mankind in the past. It is refuted by all impartial observation in the present. The facts which undermine it are seriously denied by none save those committed to the dogma in question. Like all dogmas, it is supported by bluff. In this case, the bluff is to the effect that it is the part, mark, business lot, as the Latin grammars of our youth would have had it, of the advanced man who considers himself up to date and not early Victorian to regard it as unchallengeable. Theological dogmas are backed up by the bluff of authority, either of scriptures or of churches. This dogma of the feminist cult is not vouchsafed by the authority of a communion of saints, but by that of the communion of advanced persons up to date. Unfortunately, dogma does not sit so well upon the community of advanced persons up to date, who otherwise profess to, and generally do, bring the tenets they hold to the bar of reason and critical test, as it does on a church or community of saints, who suppose themselves to be individually or collectively in communication with wisdom from on high. Be this as it may, the advanced man who would claim to be up to date has to swallow this dogma and digest it as best he can. He may secretly, it is true, spew it out of his mouth, but in public at least he must make a pretense of accepting it without flinching.
You're tuned in to Radio Stormer on thedailystormer.com.
The Anti-Man Crusade. We have already pointed out that modern feminism has two sides or aspects. The first formulates definite political, juridical, and economic demands on the grounds of justice, equity, equality, and so forth as general principles. The second does not formulate in so many words definite demands as general principles, but seems to exploit the traditional notions of chivalry based on male sex sentiment in favour of according women special privileges on the ground of their sex in the law and still more in the administration of the law. For the sake of brevity, we call the first political feminism, for although its demands are not confined to the political sphere, it is first and foremost a political movement, and its typical claim at the present time, the franchise, is a purely political one. And the second, sentimental feminism, inasmuch as it commonly does not profess to be based on any general principle whatsoever, whether of equity or otherwise, but relies exclusively on the traditional and conventional sex sentiment of man towards woman. It may be here premised that most political feminists, however much they may refuse to admit it, are at heart also sentimental feminists. Sentimental feminists, on the other hand, are not invariably political feminists, although the majority of them undoubtedly are so, to a greater or lesser extent. Logically, as we shall have occasion to insist upon later on, the principles professed at the root of political feminism are in flagrant contradiction with any that can justify sentimental feminism. Now, both the orders of feminism referred to have been active for more than a generation past in fomenting a crusade against the male sex, an anti-man crusade. Their efforts have been largely successful, owing to a fact which attention has, perhaps not enough, been called. In the case of other classes, or bodies of persons, having community of interests, this common interest invariably interprets itself in a sense of class, caste, or race solidarity. The class, or caste, has a certain esprit de corps in its own interest. The whole of history largely turns on the conflict of economic classes, based on a common feeling obtaining between members of the respective classes. On a small scale, we see the same thing in the solidarity of a particular trade or profession. But it is unnecessary to do more than call attention here to this fundamental sociological law upon which alike the class struggles of history and of modern times, the patriotism of states from the city-state of the ancient world to the national state of the modern world, is based. Now note the peculiar manner in which this law manifests itself in the sex question of the present day. While modern feminism has succeeded in establishing a powerful sex solidarity among a large section of women as against men, there is not only no sex solidarity of men as against women, but on the contrary, the prevalence of an altogether opposed sentiment. Men hate their brother men in their capacity of male persons. In any conflict of interest between a man and a woman, male public opinion, often in defiance of the most obvious considerations of equity, sides with the woman and even glories in doing so. Here, we seem to have a very flagrant contradiction with, as has already been said, one of the most fundamental of all sociological laws. The explanations of the phenomena in question are, of course, ready to hand. Tradition of chivalry, feelings, perhaps inherited, dating possibly back to the pre-human stage of man's evolution, derived from the competition of the male with his fellow male for the possession of the coveted female. These explanations may have a measure of validity, but I must confess they are to me scarcely adequate to account for the intense hatred which the large section of men seem to entertain towards their fellow males in the world of today, and their eagerness to champion the female in the sex war which the woman's sex union, as it has been termed, has declared of recent years. Whatever may be the explanation, and I confess I cannot find one completely satisfactory, the fact remains. A woman's movement, unassisted by man, still more if opposed energetically by the public opinion of a solid phalanx of the manhood of any country, could not possibly make any headway. As it is, we see the legislature, judges, juries, parsons, especially those of the non-conformist persuasion, all vying with one another in denouncing the villainy and baseness of the male person, and ever devising ways and means to make his life hard for him. To these are joined a host of literary men and journalists of varying degrees of reputation who contribute their quota to the stream of anti-manism in the shape of novels, stories, essays and articles, the design of which is to paint man as a base, contemptible creature, as at once a knave and an imbecile, a bird of prey and a sheep in wolf's clothing, and all as a foil to the glorious majesty of womanhood. There are not wanting artists who are pressed into this service. The picture of the Thames embankment at night, of the drowned unfortunate with the angel's face, the lady and gentleman in evening dress who have just got out of their cab, the lady with uplifted hands bending over the dripping form, and the callous and brutal gentleman turning aside to light a cigarette, this is a typical specimen of feminist didactic art. By these means, which have been carried on with increasing ardour for a couple of generations past, what we may term the anti-man cultus has been made to flourish and to bear fruit, till we find nowadays all recent legislation affecting the relations between the sexes carrying its impress, and the whole of the judiciary and magistracy acting as its priests and ministrants. On the subject of anti-man legislation, I have already spoken of at length elsewhere, but for the sake of completeness, I will state the case briefly here. 1. The marriage laws of England today are a monument of feminist sex partiality. If I may be excused the paradox, the partiality of the marriage laws begins with the law relating to breach of promise, which, as is well known, enables a woman to punish a man vindictively for refusing to marry her after having once engaged himself to her. I ought to add, and this oftentimes, however good his grounds may be for doing so, should the woman commit perjury in these cases, she is never prosecuted for the offence. Although the law of breach of promise exists also for the man, it is well known to be totally ineffective and practically a dead letter. It should be remarked that, however gross the misrepresentations or undue influences on the part of the woman may have been to induce the man to marry her, they do not cause her to lose her right to compensation. As, for instance, where an experienced woman of the world of 30 or 40 entraps a boy scarcely out of his teens. 2. Again, according to the law of England, the right to maintenance accrues solely to the woman. Formerly, this privilege was made dependent on her cohabitation with the man and generally decent behaviour to him. Now, even these limitations cease to be operative, while the man is liable to imprisonment and confiscation of any property he may have. A wife is now at full liberty to leave her husband, while she retains her right to get her husband sent to jail if he refuses to maintain her. To put the matter shortly, the law imposes upon the wife no legally enforceable duties whatsoever towards her husband. The one thing which it will enforce with iron vigour is the wife's right of maintenance against her husband. In the case of a man of the well-to-do classes, the man's property is confiscated by the law in favour of his wife. In the case of a working man, the law compels her husband to do corvée for her, as the feudal serf had to do for his lord. The wife, on the other hand, however wealthy, is not compelled to give a farthing towards the support of her husband, even though disabled by sickness or by accident, the single exception in the latter case being should he become chargeable to the parish, in which case the wife would have to pay the authorities a pauper's rate for his maintenance. In a word, a wife has complete possession and control over any property she may possess, as well as over her earnings, but the husband, on the other hand, is liable to confiscation of capitalized property or earnings at the behest of the law courts in favour of his wife. A wife may even make her husband bankrupt on the grounds of money she alleges that she lent him. Her husband, on the other hand, has no claim against his wife for any money advanced, since a husband is supposed to give and not to lend his wife money or other valuables. 3. The law affords the wife a right to commit torts against third parties. For example, libels, slanders, the husband alone being responsible. And this rule applies even though the wife is living apart from her husband, who is wholly without knowledge of her misdeeds. With the exception of murder, a wife is held by the law to be guiltless of practically any crime committed in the presence of her husband. 4. No man can obtain a legal separation or divorce from his wife, save under the Licensing Act of 1902, a police court separation for habitual drunkenness alone, without a costly process in the High Court. Every wife can obtain, if not a divorce, at least a legal separation by going whining to the nearest police court for a few shillings, which her husband, of course, has to pay. The latter, it is needless to say, is mulcted in alimony at the discretion of the court. This discretion is very often of a queer character for the luckless husband. Thus, a working man earning only 20 shillings a week may easily find himself in the position of having to pay from 7 to 10 shillings a week to a shrew out of his wages. In cases where a wife proceeds to file a petition for divorce, the way is once more smoothed over for her by the law at the husband's expense. He has to advance her money to enable her to fight him. Should the case come on for hearing, the husband finds the scale still more weighted against him. Every slander of his wife is assumed to be true until he has proved its falsity. The slightest act or a word during a moment of irritation, even a long time back, being twisted into what is termed legal cruelty, even though such has been provoked by a long course of ill treatment and neglect on the part of the wife. The husband and his witnesses can be indicted for perjury for the slightest exaggeration or inaccuracy in their statements, while the most calculated falsity in the evidence of the wife and her witnesses is passed over. Not the grossest allegation on the part of the wife against the husband, even though proved in court to be false, is sufficient ground for the husband to refuse to take her back again, or from preventing the court from confiscating his property if he resists doing so. Knowledge of the unfairness of the court to the husband, as all lawyers are aware, prevents a large number of men from defending divorce actions brought by their wives. A point should here be mentioned. As regards the action of a husband for damages against the seducer of his wife. Such damages obviously belong to the husband as compensation for his destroyed home life. Now these damages, our modern judges, in their feminist zeal, have converted into a fund for endowing the adulteress, depriving the husband of any compensation whatsoever for the wrong done him. He may not touch the income derived from the money awarded him by the jury, which is handed over by the court to his divorced wife. It will take us too long to go through all the privileges, direct and indirect, conferred by statute or created by the rulings of judges and the practice of the courts in favour of the wife against the husband. It is the more unnecessary to go into them here, as they may be found in detail with illustrative cases in the aforesaid pamphlet in which I collaborated, entitled The Legal Subjection of Men. At this point, it may be well to say a word on the one rule of the divorce law which feminists are perennially trotting out as a proof of the shocking injustice of the marriage law to women. That to obtain her divorce, the woman has to prove cruelty in addition to adultery against her husband, while in the case of the husband, it is sufficient to prove adultery alone. Now, to make of this rule a grievance for the woman is, I submit, evidence of the destitution of the feminist case. In default of any real injustice pressing on the woman, the feminist is constrained to make as much capital as possible out of the merest semblance of a grievance he can lay his hand on. The reasons for this distinction, which the law draws between the husband and the wife, it is obvious enough, are perfectly well grounded. It is based mainly on the simple fact that while a woman by her adultery may foist upon her husband a bastard, which he will be compelled by law to support as his own child, in the husband's case of having an illegitimate child, the wife and her property are not affected. Now, in a society such as ours is, based upon private property holding, it is only natural, I submit, that the law should take account of this fact. But not only is this rule of law almost certainly doomed to repeal in the near future, but in even the present day, while it still nominally exists, it is practically a dead letter in the divorce court, since any trivial act of which the wife chooses to complain about is strained by the court into evidence of cruelty in the legal and technical sense. As the matter stands, the practical effect of the rule is a much greater injustice to the husband than to the wife, since the former often finds himself convicted of cruelty, which is virtually nothing at all, in order that the wife's petition may be granted, and which is often made the excuse by feminist judges for depriving the husband of the custody of his children. Misconduct on the wife's part, or neglect of husband and children, does not weigh with the court, which will not, on that grounds, grant relief to the husband from his obligation for maintenance. On the other hand, neglect of the wife by the husband is made a ground for judicial separation with the usual consequences of alimony. Thus, as it has been put, between the upper and the nether millstone, cruelty on the one hand, neglect on the other, the unhappy husband can be legally ground to pieces, whether he does anything or whether he does nothing. Personal violence on the part of the husband is severely punished. On the part of the wife, she will be let off with impunity. Even if she should, in an extreme case, be imprisoned, the husband, if a poor man, on her release, will be compelled to take her back to live with him. The case came under the notice of the writer a few years ago, in which a humane magistrate was constrained to let off a woman who had nearly murdered her husband on the condition of her graciously consenting to a separation, but she had presumably still to be supported by her victim. The decision, in the notorious Jackson case, precluded the husband from compelling his wife to obey an order of the court for the restitution of conjugal rights. The persistent feminist tendency of all case law is illustrated by a decision of the House of Lords in 1894 in reference to the law of Scotland, constituting desertion for 4 years a ground ipso facto for a divorce with the right of remarriage. Here, divorce was refused to a man whose wife had left him for 4 years and taken her child with her. The law lords justified their own interpretation of the law on the grounds that the man did not really want her to come back. But inasmuch as this plea can be started in every case where it cannot be proved that the husband had absolutely grovelled before his wife, imploring her to return, and possibly even then, since the sincerity even of this grovelling might conceivably be called into question, it is clear that the decision practically rendered this old Scottish law inoperative for the husband.